Session number 12367.
Mr. West, reel 2. How did you transfer from the Palestine police to Malayan duties, please?
We left Palestine in June 1948, waited for a ship to bring us out of Haifa, and on the way home we were handed little forms saying, would you be interested in continuing to serve in the colonial service? And I said yes, I would, and went home and was on leave, starting to think about going back into civilian life, and I got a cable from the colonial office saying, would I come to London and talk to them about going to Malaya? And I thought that would be a fascinating thing to do. I'd enormously enjoyed the 2 years in, or less, slightly less than 2 years in Palestine, and I thought it would be interesting to go on and see a little more of the world. And so a fortnight later we were put on an old Skymaster, 54 of us, and flown out to Malaya. I think it was a charter for Skyways at that time, but it took 3 days because they were very slow and overloading, and they had to stop every few hours. And then we got there. We arrived there on a Saturday morning in Singapore, and were put on a train and sent off to Kuala Lumpur.
This is September 48.
Yes, that's right. And of course, there was no formal training there at all. There were some people from Palestine were recruited in gazetted ranks, people like Catlin and so on, and the great majority of us were given the rank of sergeant. And our duties were to, at that time, to go out into the rubber estates and protect the rubber industry by raising and training largely Malay special constables to garrison the bungalows and to protect the planters in the field and the factories, who had all come under pretty severe attack. So I think we arrived at Kuala Lumpur station at 8 o'clock in the morning, and by 11 o'clock that day I was at my station, which was in Kepong district, north of Kuala Lumpur, getting to know what a special constable was and what the points were that we had to protect, and starting to prepare them to do that. Up to then, the planters had been doing it themselves. Some of them were ex-soldiers, and they'd taken on this responsibility. And we were given a group of estates, 20 or so estates, which we then had to look after and travel between and do our best to protect. It was an interesting role. And, of course, you concentrated on firearms. We constructed little jungle walks, shooting ranges, minor tactics, and occasionally attempted offensive operations. This was a very formative time, because one's map reading suddenly had to make enormous strides, and of course the best way to learn anything is to teach it. And one taught oneself more about shooting in closed conditions than one had ever had to do in Palestine. Organized rosters, training sessions, night patrols. It was all very, very amusing. And at that stage, we didn't often see much action, although I had a few chaps killed on one estate I was looking after.
How did that come about?
They were ambushed one of the things you learn after a time is that you never actually change a guard at 10 o'clock every day or 11 o'clock every day. You really have to find systems for relieving people by different methods at different times. And some of us weren't too bright about that in the early days of the emergency. And of course, then it was a question of teaching our trainer, our planters who we were responsible for, to do the same thing. So one learnt on the job, as it were.
What were the Malays like as material for special constables?
They were the ones that came in because they would do it for the money and they were available. They were Kampong lads. I liked them very much. I found them cheerful and happy and willing. And not particularly brave, but I think you got out of them what you put into them. They were very intelligent. They were subject to reason. And if one took a fair bit of time to explain just what you were trying to do, they responded well. The initial problem was the language, but when you're on your own in the bush with a group of Malays who can't speak English, it's amazing what it does for your language facility. So most of us learnt it by strict contact. And then we had munshis or teachers taught us the academic things. One got quite good at Malay quite quickly.
What did you feel about the plight of the rubber planters in 1948?
It was very precarious. I think quite a number of them were extraordinarily heroic in sticking to their jobs and sticking to their outposts. The terrorists weren't terribly, now you look back on it, they weren't terribly well organized. They could have done much more damage than they ever did. But the planters did a superb job, I reckon, for their employers and for the country. They took it very much as part of their duty to stay there, and I don't think it was just the money.
Did you ever get many complaints from them?
Not really. Rather the contrary. They were very pleased when you turned up in the middle of the night on a patrol and they perhaps didn't wake up and weren't asleep, but they heard about it first thing in the morning. And I think people were very grateful, by and large, for what we did. There was the odd one who thought his chaps were slack and idle and we didn't do enough about it. But by and large, no, I think they were very appreciative of what we were trying to do.
Was there much slashing of rubber trees and economic damage in that area then?
There was a bit attempted, yes. It came in waves. But the main attack was against factories and against the persons of actual planters. But rubber slashing was such a hopeless task. They used to pick the high quality young rubber, which did more damage, but there was very little you could do about that. It used to take place in the middle of the night. But then again, one or two of the planters did develop, and I know one in particular, a very good intelligence network through his labour force. And one was able to use that to good effect. We eliminated a fair number of terrorists on the edges and just in from the rubber estates with the aid of the workforces on the estates themselves.
You've written here that you transferred from Selangor to Kajang in August 1949.
Mm. Well, that was again, Kajang was where one of the places where the emergency started and was hottest. It was just south of Kuala Lumpur. And I was then, by that time, a jungle squad man. I'd graduated from just training and looking after rubber estates to actually taking regular policemen on jungle patrols. Our job was the jungle edges, the Buluka and the squatter areas on the jungle edges, and we used to patrol those fairly extensively. And with the object of chance encounter and quite often on intelligence or seeking intelligence. That was quite hairy, those days in Kajang.
Are there any incidents there that you can recount that happened to you?
Oh yes, there were several. We had our little jungle squad was very nervous about travelling down these dangerous roads in open trucks. And we had a scout car, which was the main defence, which carried a Bren gun sticking out of the front, and it was completely open at the top. And after being shot at a couple of times on some of these roads, I devised the idea that we ought to modify this scout car, our own scout car, and there were some old armoured cars at Kajang station that had been wrecked and left there when the Japanese came down, and they had armour plate on them. So my boss at that time allowed me to spend some Secret Service funds, and we went and got a local Chinese garage man to cut these armoured cars up, or cut one of them up. And we devised a turret, a cover for our open-topped scout car, and a turret with a Bren gun mounting on it. This turned the tables. Our armoured car would sit at the back of the convoy, and if somebody ran into trouble at the front, it would move in and mix it. And this was a great tactical advantage for us. We got into trouble with it because somebody in the police force transport department didn't like what we'd done without authority to his scout car. And there was a bit of an inquiry, and I think my boss got ragged, and I was sort of ticked off. But they then copied it and put one on every scout car that they had throughout the Federation, which was rather fun, I thought. But the Malay policemen never understood why the armoured car always went behind. And they had one of their songs, they used to make up songs, was the Tapi armoured car Mingingkut Belakang. You go to Broga down this dangerous road and you're sitting in your open trucks and people shoot at you, but the armoured car is always at the back. You know, they always thought it should go to the front. And you could never convince them that if it went on to the front and somebody dropped a tree in between the armoured car and them, they'd be stuck because he couldn't get back to help them. They never actually, I think they understood it, but it was always a source of some amused complaint from them. We bumped off quite a few terrorists there. There was a man called Derek Mole, who was the OCPD, who was an ex-Gurkha and very keen on his jungle patrols, and I think we got some very good intelligence, and we had a very good regiment there with us, the Suffolk Regiment, who were brilliant.
Why were they so good?
It's very interesting. Over the years, you saw different regiments, and it was all and the way they performed. I rather formed the theory that countrymen who were a bit slow and deliberate always performed better on their own, in small numbers, in the countryside. And townies from Glasgow and Cardiff and London and Manchester never seemed to do so well. Now, that's probably assuming things that one shouldn't, but that was the that was the theory that a few of us came up with, but it was usually because they had a very good commanding officer, and that was certainly true with the Suffolks. They were extraordinarily good. The Guards Brigade, of course, were the opposite. They were not very effective at all. They were too big, we always thought. If there was a creeper or a liana or something that was going to knock their hats off, or they'd bump into it and curse, and I didn't think that they were nearly as effective. Well, they weren't. The raw numbers of eliminations and contacts simply showed that.
Are there any of the successes that you had that you can describe that you were involved in personally at close quarters, at Kajang?
Well, there were some... well, I think my very first one was a bit of a mix-up in close Bluka, secondary jungle, where one advanced a little further than one should and got isolated, and popped one's head up above the reeds to find a terrorist about 2 feet away popping his head up as well, and we both frightened the life out of one another and took off. But we got him a little later. But there was another occasion where, on very good intelligence, we went out, and I took my squad out with a platoon of the Scots Guards, and we put them as the drivers in this through this covert, and we were stopping at the edges, on the edges of the rubber estate. There was an area of secondary jungle, and they were beating through, and we got five. They were to run into us, but they didn't actually run into us. They stayed put and fought it out in the blue cone. But two of my chaps got killed in the crossfire. I don't think the terrorists killed them. It was just that people were tending to blaze off with Bren guns, and they're not discriminating where they hit. But there were a number of actions like that that we were party to.
How was it that you managed in the end to get that gorilla who stuck his head up above the reeds?
Well, the action went on, and we'd got a cordon round it, and they eventually ran into us. Sometimes they could get so disorganized that they would bounce off you and back in again, and if you could keep a fairly thin cordon going, providing you had good intelligence and knew exactly where they were, and you in the middle of the night very quietly with a good deal of care, you were able to get a thin line around them, and they would try and break out, and then when one of them got hit, they would bounce back in again, and you could keep the game going for some hours that way.
Was it of any importance to capture the gorillas, or was it just a question of killing them?
Oh no, it was always it was tremendously important to capture them. And we would go to immense lengths to try and capture them. They were a tremendous source of intelligence and understanding. And the emphasis was always on trying to get prisoners.
How could you do that?
Well, by hanging on, when you got him in your sights, hanging on there, wondering whether he was going to move or not. And if he didn't, and you could occasionally speak to him, watching very carefully, particularly the women. But he would throw after a bit, he would throw his hand in and just surrender to you.
Why particularly the women?
Oh, they were always much more fanatical. At least one woman I went near took a pin out of a hand grenade and blew herself up and tried to take me with her. But they were much more. There weren't many, but they were very fanatical terrorists.
Was that incident at Kajang?
Yes.
Was that... did that turn out to be a particularly bad area in 49?
Oh, it was, yes. Hmm.
Why do you think that was so?
It was close to the capital. It was a mixture of rubber and jungle, mountainous at the edge. and had a particularly virulent gang there under a regimental commander called Liu Kon Kim, who the Suffolks eventually accounted for. But it was a centre of union and it was a great centre during the Japanese time when the Force 136 and the anti-Japanese Chinese forces were grouped there. It had a tradition of militancy.
Did you see any of the Kajang guerrillas at close hand, either dead or alive?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, several.
What, did they have uniforms?
Oh, they had khaki uniforms with little narrow peak caps with a red star in the middle. Some were better equipped and uniformed than others. But then some of them, the Mingyuan was the supply unit that lived on the jungle edges and collected rice and money and oil and things and shipped it back into the bigger units. They never had uniform. They were armed, but they were all dressed like rubber tappers. And that was difficult sometimes to be sure that you were actually getting a terrorist and not a rubber tapper. After a bit, you could tell by the way they walked and the way they carried on, but it was very important not to hit innocent civilians. It was, and one of the reasons I think why we were so successful there was that there was very little incidence of that.
What was the distinctive way in which the guerrilla walked and behaved?
You could tell by whether there were two or three of them grouped together, which direction they were going. And if they were rubber tappers, you'd be expecting them to be behaving in a certain way. And they didn't have buckets, and they didn't have tapping knives, and they didn't have bicycles very often. And they were generally purposeful. They were going somewhere, two or three of them. And I don't think we ever really got it seriously wrong. Poor old Scots Guards got it seriously wrong. But that was perhaps the only major upsetting incident where a lot of civilians were quite unjustly and not entirely accidentally killed.
What happened?
It was at a place called Batankali. I was subsequently, as you'll see on that list, I was subsequently OCPD Rawang. And
this was in August 51, put down here.
Rawang, yes. But before that, the three platoons of the Scots Guards under a sergeant had gone off on a jungle patrol to learn about it. It was a training patrol, really, and they came into a clearing where there were 26, I think it was, people who they thought were behaving suspiciously. Actually, it was a tiny little battle axe rubber estate inside the jungle with a road to it. And they, I think out of sheer ignorance and fear, somebody started to shoot. All the tappers ran away and most of them were killed. And they certainly weren't terrorists. Some of them were, perhaps had links with terrorists. But there was no call for shooting them.
Can you understand how something like that could have happened?
To platoons of young squaddies straight out from the UK with very little experience, prickly heat and all the other diseases and horrors, not being properly led, I could understand it. I couldn't excuse it, but I can understand it.
Was it horrific being in the jungle?
No. Jungle is a lovely place. it is a most divine environment. And the deeper you got, the nicer it was. The jungle edges were fairly dangerous because the terrace tended to be, you know, a few thousand yards inside. But I did a lot of big jungle time, and that was extraordinarily attractive. It's cool, and the streams are delightful. If you're quiet and careful, you see and hear a lot of animals and birds. I used to wonder why you got paid for it. It was spending one's time. It was always a joy to me, the jungle. Never afraid of it at all. There's a very good book by Spencer Chapman called The Jungle is Neutral, who describes it beautifully. It was a pain to some people. It used to worry the noises of the insects and things that they didn't understand used to worry quite a lot of people.
Yes, I was going to say that some people I've interviewed have described being in the jungle in very different terms as very all the discomforts of being there.
Yes, well, when it rains, of course.
The leeches and so on.
Yes, well, you got entirely used to those. It was part one of the little... I think people go into the jungle now and accept the leeches and pay for it. We used to get it for